Good afternoon. For those of you who may be new this afternoon, I don't know for sure, I'm John O'Neill, and I am a staff chaplain at the Worcester Corrections Center, involved in chaplaincy as well as pursuing intensive study in a clinical pastoral education program that's conducted there by our Lutheran chaplain, Ray Lester. I'm also Lutheran, and Lutheran background, and a little bit of my background. I thought today that I would share a little bit of some information presented by some outstanding figures, which I think most of you are aware of, have heard about, and know who they are generally, to give us a build-up and a lead-in to rehabilitation. Part of the subject is, do prisons prevent crimes? One of the principal justifications for using prisons to punish crime is the belief that prisons are deterrent to criminal behavior. But crime statistics show that imprisonment is a very questionable deterrent to crime. Instead of deterring crime, our prisons contribute to it, and our experience in prisons supports this assertion. More than half of the prisoners in America are incarcerated for nonviolent crimes. In some jurisdictions, this figure is as high as 70%. If placing nonviolent offenders in a penitentiary can often be counterproductive. Frequently, they are subjected to brutal treatment, homosexual rape, continual threat of violence, and a boring routine that deadens the human spirit. Studies have shown that a great many nonviolent offenders come out of prison not rehabilitated, but instead in far worse mental, physical, and moral condition than when they went in. Also involved in this breakup and this breakdown of human beings behind the walls, the effect that it has on the families. Too often, I think we get wound up with thinking strictly about the inmate, and we forget the families. I think I mentioned yesterday that for every inmate, statistics in the state, in this state, state that each inmate affects seven other people. Wife, children, parents, whatever. So we have that problem to deal with, and we in the chaplaincy do get involved in that dynamic. Part of that situation that develops from that is more often than not, the prison, the incarceration, the long-term incarceration leads to the breakup of the family. If there was a strong family unit, it generally breaks down. It's pretty difficult for a family to continue to support that person over years of time. It's kind of interesting when we start dealing with individuals. When we run onto a family or a wife who remains very supportive, we're really, really excited because we've got something to work with. Because without some outside support, some backup, any hope of that person, almost any hope of that person staying out of the institution and not coming back is very slight. It's very difficult. Further, felony disability statutes in most states deprive the ex-offender of his civil liberties, including his right to vote. And this makes it very difficult for him to return to a normal life in society. Difficult to get a job, difficult to get back into a normal, what we call a normal routine. In the state of Washington, the procedure is that a man, he does lose his civil rights in this state. Now, we're not talking about constitutional rights now, we're talking about civil rights. The right to bear arms, or the right to own a weapon, to vote. I'm not sure what all of them are, but those, I think, are the two main ones.
You mean he can't vote the rest of his life?
No, I'm going to clear that up right now. After a man goes before the parole board and is given a parole date, they put restrictions, quite often put restrictions on him that he has to live by. And those restrictions, basically there are three that are on every parolee. One is he cannot leave the state without permission. He cannot, he must report monthly to his parole officer. And the third one is that he cannot have a firearm. Then in addition to those, the parole board or the parole and probation officer may add other restrictions on him. If his crime has been alcohol related, he probably will be not allowed to go around bars or be found in a bar or taverns or that type of thing. Or if it's been involved in child abuse in one form or another, then he's kept away from those people. And this is all listed on his papers when he is separated or goes on parole. He is on what we call active parole, which is means that he must report once a month to his parole, once a month to his parole officer and let him know how he's doing. If he wants to buy a car, he checks with that. If he wants to get married, there's still the control of that person. Not quite as much as it was in prison, but there is still a lot of strings on him. And I think, by and large, justified. The problem is, in this state, and I'm sure it's where this state is representative of every other state, that the caseload of the parole officer is such that it's almost impossible for him to provide the time that he needs to maybe help that individual. Quite often, I have a friend of mine who is a parole and probation officer. His caseload sometimes runs 125 people. There's no way in the world that he can see 125 people once a month and spend any time with them. They can walk in the front door, check off a list, and walk out, and that's about it. So it's very difficult. So consequently, he's pretty much at loose ends and really sometimes doesn't have the support that he would really need. Well, he's usually on active parole for at least a year. And it can be longer depending on the felony and so forth. After a year, he can apply for inactive parole. Generally, they don't get it within a year. It runs probably a minimum 18 months as a rule. Here again, depending on the felony. If he's accepted and placed on inactive parole, that means he reports once a year to his parole officer, and that doesn't preclude the parole officer at any time checking up on him. He can go to his home. He has the right to question most any movement the parolee makes. After 18 months, or after completing anywhere from a year, plus or minus whatever the parole board or the probation officer places on him, he can discharge him from inactive parole At that point, he can apply for restoration of all of his rights. Normally, that's done at the time he's discharged from inactive parole, which means then he gets back all of his civil rights, voting and that. The only one that I'm questioning about, and I'm not sure, and I don't know, Fred, you may know the answer to that one. I'm not sure whether they get the right to have a weapon again or not. It seems to me that's a federal statute, and I'm not sure. I'm not sure whether, but questionable about that one. That's the only one. But everything else, he does get the right to all of his civil rights restored, so that allows him to vote. However, unfortunately, for whatever reason, the largest percent of these people either are not aware of this system of parole and application for inactive parole, and lots of guys will be carrying a tail, as they call it, for years. Some of them, their maximum sentence, they can maintain a parole on a person up to their maximum sentence, whether it's 5, 10, 15, 20 years, unless they have been discharged from active parole or inactive parole or discharged from their whole case is closed. And when it's closed, that's the end of that case. It doesn't have anything to do then with another case that they might get involved in reoffending. The FBI report is that 74% of the offenders released from prison are rearrested within 4 years. And once we put a person in prison, the odds are that he will get out of prison, commit another crime, and return behind bars. A vicious cycle goes on and on. A recent television documentary, maybe some of you saw it, after dramatizing this process, closed with a sober warning. Maybe prisoners do deserve what they get here in prison, but maybe we deserve what we get when they eventually get out. 98% of all prisoners are released sooner or later. 98% of them get out at one time or another. So what that says to me is, how do we want these people to come back into our society? Do we want them to come back as, hopefully, quotes, rehabilitated people, good members of society? Or do we want them to come back in the same manner in which they went out? And unfortunately, at this point, it seems that most of them are coming back out, in many cases worse than they went in. Kind of, Ray Lester and I were talking not too long ago, and somebody we were talking about last night mentioned it, but that if we can keep that person from being any worse when he goes out than when he came in, we feel we've done something. And that's really a sad commentary, but it seems more often than not that's kind of the way it is. If we can just keep him status quo, we've gained a little bit. In 1977, perplexed and frustrated by the seeming inability of prisons to deter crime, the Canadian Parliament commissioned an exhaustive study of the Canadian prison system. And the study concluded, society has spent millions of dollars over the years to create and maintain the proven failure of prisons. Incarceration has failed in its two essential purposes, correcting the offender and providing permanent protection to society. The recidivist rate of up to 80% is the evidence of both. Now, I want to make one thing clear. When I'm talking about the failures of prisons, I am not pointing a finger or tearing down the people involved in the criminal justice system, because they are only doing what we as society mandate. We tell them what we want and they do it. And as I said every session, and I will underline this, they're doing a pretty good job with what they have to deal with. Funding, many, many different things. And when I talk about the criminal justice system, I'm talking about the whole system. The prosecuting attorneys, the judges, the courts of law, everything is involved in the system. And they are doing a pretty good job with what they have to deal with. So I'm talking from the level of what happens with the person in the prison system, which we have mandated. I mentioned yesterday that prisons cost upwards of $80,000 a bed to build. Right now we have one going, as I mentioned, in Mason County, where I'm from, New County Jail. I was talking to the auditor not too long ago that put that all together fund-wise. $88,000 per bed for a 40-unit county jail. Your tax dollars. Dissatisfaction with prisons and their effectiveness in dealing with crime is widespread among American observers. Chief Justice Warren Burger recently said, "We have developed systems of correction which do not correct. If anyone is tempted to regard humane prison reform as coddling criminals, let him visit a prison and talk with inmates and staff. I have visited some of the best and some of the worst prisons and have never seen any signs of coddling. But I have seen the terrible results of the boredom and frustration of empty hours and pointless existence." In 1969, President Richard Nixon asserted that the American system for correction and rehabilitation presents a convincing case of failure. No realistic program to substantially reduce crime can ignore the appalling deficiencies of our prisons and rehabilitation efforts. And for me, I have to speak from my own experience within our system of rehabilitation. I struggle with that word because I don't see any of it happening. We have almost 1,200 men in a facility originally built for 800. We bring them in. They're given, by and large, long-term sentences. And they sit there in the prison and do practically nothing. I think that far as Shelton is concerned, we do have his high school, which helps. And as I mentioned, vocational schools and that type of thing. We had an alcohol and drug program that's been done away with, budget cuts. Each hall is supposed to have two counselors. At the present rate, well, first of all, most of the halls have one counselor, only because of the shortage of counselors. We can't get them. Or else they've been the job has been abolished or is held in abeyance waiting for funding, numerous things. So I'm speaking now of Shelton, each one of our halls, as we call them, contain 120 men. And there's one counselor to deal with 120 men. in some, I'm not even sure, I was trying to think if we had one hall that maybe had two, but I don't think so. I can't think of it. Spruce Hall, which I mentioned is our intake hall, which originally housed 120 men. They double bunked it, part of it, and now there's one council there dealing with 180 men. Here again, there is no way that this counselor can deal on a one-to-one basis with that inmate in an effort to help him. All he can do, and he has a difficult time and in lots of times doesn't accomplish it, just doing the paperwork necessary to keep that man going or keep his case moving and take care of the unprogrammed things that come up, deaths in the family, illness, many things that happen to inmates. See, we have the same situation within our community that you have in your community outside. You have deaths in the family, illnesses, accidents, many, many things. One of the things that we deal with as chaplains in conjunction with the counselors in the halls are deaths and serious illness, children, wives, mothers, fathers, and so forth. In the case of a death or a terminal illness or very critical accident to a close family member, a close family member means mother, father, brother, sister, wife, in some cases grandparents, depending on whether that grandparent has been pretty much involved in the raising of that individual, much of the family, how close grandparent is. Now, if there's a death we'll take your area, Fred, Clark County, or say Vancouver, and the inmate wants to go to the funeral, providing he doesn't have a split record, and by that we mean escape, and he is not felt to be a person who's going to cause him a lot of problems. His behavior, his attitude has been halfway decent and so forth. They probably will approve that. But what that does is to go from Shelton to Clark County and return to Vancouver is going to cost that man somewhere, or his family, somewhere in the neighborhood of $200 for that round trip. Now that's to pay for two officers to go with him and the vehicle and the mileage back and forth. They take him out in chains and take him down to the funeral home or wherever. They remove the handcuffs and the chains, of course, generally. If there's a question, they may not. They have that prerogative not to. But we're dealing with people in a very low income bracket generally. Most families do not have those kinds of funds, and generally the inmate doesn't. There's exceptions to that, but they're few and far between. So consequently, the man doesn't get out to the, very seldom gets out to the funeral. So this here again puts another burden on this individual. He's living in a negative environment. He has no, most of them have very little hope of employment or a bright light at the end of the tunnel. The counselor tries to deal with those areas, but it's just impossible with that many people on his caseload. There's a continual effort to, where possible, where the felony allows it, to get a man out to camp. which is the first step toward eventual release. He comes into the reception center, is classified, goes to one of the prisons in our state. He then spends a certain amount of time there, goes out to a camp, one of our forest honor camps, as they're called, and then generally to work release, and at that point, possibly, hopefully parole, assuming that he maintains his attitude and his effort toward rehabilitating himself. There's a lot of things affect what happens there. We have had people out at camps who have been brought back very recently. Some of them have been out as much as 2 years into the camps, doing well, no problem, but because of the infamous Campbell case up in Everett, which some of you may or may not be aware of, were brought back because it was this Campbell case is a situation where a man from Monroe, I believe, was on work release, and he was originally a sex offender. He went out, and after a short period of time, he located the woman that he'd originally raped, who testified against him, killed her and another woman and an 11-year-old child. So how do we deal with those kind of things? The general feeling from people who have been involved in that situation feel that the man never should have been released on work, to go on work release. I don't know, I might didn't work with him, I don't know, but the general feeling was that obviously he should not have been released for what happened. Yes?
I think he publicly stated that he was going to get that woman prior to being in prison. At least privately he had, and I think it was publicly known, commonly known.
That's probably, I'm sure, I mean, you hear that all the time, you know. And it's like sorting out the chaff from the wheat. How much of it is talk and how much of it is fact? In this case, it was fact, you know. And very obviously, it's very difficult for you, me, trained counselors, anybody else, to sit down and say, hey, yeah, this guy's okay, or this guy's okay. We just don't know. Part of what I talk about is the treatment of sex offenders. We deal with them a lot. The sex offender generally will set and fantasize his particular form of offense, whether it's child molestation, sexual abuse, rape, whatever, flashers. They'll sit in prison and they'll fantasize this the whole time they're there. More often than not, they will replace their problem with religion. And they do that very simply by acknowledging God's forgiveness. He has forgiven me, I don't have to deal with my problem. And we deal with that all the time. If there is not some form of therapy to take a sex offender, and they are our greatest risks on parole, and we seem to have a tremendous amount of them. But if there isn't some work done with that man to get him to acknowledge what he's done, most of them will block it or deny it. They go into a denial pattern, and they'll block it, deny it, saying, well, I really didn't hurt him, or I didn't mean to do it, whatever. they'll rationalize and deny what they've done. And before we can help that person, or anybody can help that person, they have to be dealt with in such a manner that they start taking responsibility for their actions and understand what they've done and the ramifications of it, and then start to understand why they did it. And by and large, what we find that offender, a sex offender, has been a child, been abused, an abused child themselves, been beaten many times, been raped by the father, whether it's boy or girl, doesn't make any difference, or some member of the family, an uncle, a boyfriend, whatever. There's a history and a pattern there. The rapist generally is a person who is a very, very angry person, a person who has been dominated probably all his life and generally by women, either a mother, some female member of the family, an older sister, a wife, to the point where he's never been able to be in control. So his method of control is to take a small child or a young girl or a woman that he can overpower and that he's in control. Well, before you can help, you've got to get him to understand that. You've got to deal with that. And at that point, you have some hope, and I underline some, of turning him around. And it's a long-term process. But right now, in our prison system, we are taking these people and locking them up and not doing anything about it, or very little about it. We cannot force them to go into a sex offender program. We have one at Shelton. In fact, Ray Lester, our chaplain who was here last week, conducts that.
Why can't that be required?
Well, it's somehow or other, and I'm not just sure how, falls under the constitutional rights. We can't make them work either. They don't want to work, they don't have to. But what happens is, the parole board can make them wish they'd worked, or make them wish they'd gone to some of these things.
How's that?
Well, they just tell them, hey, you haven't done anything, so we'll see you in 2 years. They don't get any cuts, they don't get any action from the parole board.
What usually happens?
Generally. You see, that man's got a jacket. When the parole board goes to interview this man, generally they, depending on the length of their sentence, they go before the board every year, every 2 years, with the case of life sentences, which is a mandatory 13-4 years. Maybe it's every 3 years. They call them progress hearings. So, say for instance, they lay out a 10-year minimum sentence for me, and just after my first initial appearance before the board, then they will review me and say, we'll see you in 2 years. But then in 2 years, on that date that they first saw me, they will see me again. And at that point, they'll have my file. Everything that I've done, either positive or negative, will be in that file. And they go over that.
So it sounds like even though they go through the review hearings, that doesn't make any difference, that most of the, I get the sense that most of these guys just sit around and don't go and don't do and don't rehabilitate.
No, largest percent program.
Pardon?
The largest percent of the program, do something.
I see.
But first of all, we couldn't handle, if all of them that we've got, sex offenders, wanted to come into a class, there's no way we could handle it. We don't have the people, number one. And number two is, they don't have to, they're not forced to.
Right.
Now, they do have the Western State Hospital, and I don't know whether you're from the state of Washington or not, but we have a Western State Hospital over at Stillicum, Washington, on the west side of the mountains, and Eastern State on this side of the mountains. They have the sex offender program there that is quite an intensive reality therapy program. And I don't know. I hear a lot for it. I hear a lot against it. I hear, of course, I quite often hear a lot from the inmate himself. What happens is, quite often, the sex offender will be assigned, will be a sentence. He's given, say, a 10-year sentence, and then he will be sentenced to this sex offender unit at Eastern or Western State Hospital, and then if he completes that. He goes back before the court, and the court deals with him at that point, either more time or they feel that his psychiatrists and psychologists feel that he has improved substantially and got a handle on things, paroling type of thing, or work release. Now, if they don't finish it successfully, then they go back before the court, and they go down the shelf to do it for imprisonment. Even though they may have been sentenced to the program for 3 years, and they do two of it, and they don't finish the last part, makes no difference. That's all lost time. They go back and start over again in that program.
I mean, if he opts not to finish it, are there other reasons why the inmate might not finish?
No, only if he opts not to, or the people in charge of the program feel he's just sitting there twiddling his thumbs, not being involved, and
so he could be asked to leave the program.
Yeah, they can just tell him, hey, or referring back to the court, this man's not part of the program. He's not investing in it. He's not trying. He's not doing a thing. And at this point, we feel there's no more hope for him, or no help for him here.
Those persons are placed there if they're found to be a sexual psych offender.
Big part.
Those
yes.
persons are sent there or committed if they're found to be a sexual psych offender.
That's right. That's right.
And then you have to bring up for parole, even though that's the case.
Excuse me, I'm
trying to understand the system as it deals with this particular type of individual, and what I'm hearing is. An individual gets sent into a rehabilitation program and may decide himself or herself not to finish the program, or the staff may say, you're not participating in the program, back you go until you decide you want to participate, and now you're saying that they can be then, on a psychiatric basis, judged to be a sexual psychopath, in which case they're kicked out of the program too?
No, I don't think that's what they go.
If they're found guilty of a sexual offense, the person, instead of being sentenced to penitentiary or prison, there may be a further hearing to determine if that person is a sexual psychopath. And if it's found that he is a sexual psychopath, then he's committed to the program at the hospital. And it's an intensive program. You have to graduate from one level to another. Eventually,
it's a very confrontive reality therapy program, and it's from my understanding, it's a tough program.
And does this have a better statistic for rehabilitation than other rehabilitation programs in other prisons for other things?
I don't know the statistics.
In other words, is it worth the bucks?
Big part.
Is it worth the bucks, and are we doing what we want to do in terms of rehabilitating a person back into a more normal role in society?
Well, I would have to assume at this point that it is worth the dollars. Otherwise,
you're quoting some statistics that really kind of discourage.
Well, we're talking about two different situations here.
This is a special program. First of all, I have to be found to be a sexual psychopath. And then they're committed to the program as a substitute for
imprisonment.
It's kind of an
alternative. And if they don't finish the program, then they're sent back to serve their sentence, right?
I think maybe the confusion came in that that's different than the one that Bud runs at Shaw's.
Yes, that's a different program.
He's not talking about the sexual offenders program that takes place in the prison, but rather the one that's located at Eastern and Western State Hospitals.
Those are entirely different programs. Not all sex offenders are committed to that program at Eastern or Western State.
What's the difference? What's the difference between a sex offender and a sex...
Between a...
A sex offender and a
sexual
offender.
And a sexual psychopath?
Yes.
Well, I'm not a doctor, but...
That's a medical question.
Yeah, really. Yeah, I don't really think I have the expertise to answer that.
Sexual, we need medical testimony.
I mean, they're both sex.
In order for the court to make the commitment.
Oh, yeah, they're both
sick.
Sex. Sick, yeah.
Yeah,
right.
One
they're
is
both.
Just more sick than the other. One is sicker.
Sicker, I guess. I'm not really sure. Certainly sick. No, not all sex offenders go into that program, that sexual psychopath program. And I guess I'd have to stay here, too.
I'm sorry, I didn't interrupt.
After I get through, I'll try to maybe clarify some of that for you. Lost it. Psychopath, the sexual psychopath, or criminal psychopath, either, whatever, are almost impossible to do much for. Almost. The criminal personality is very interesting. There's some 52 traits that every criminal personality has in common. And it's very interesting when you get into studying that. And they all have them. They found them in study at St. Elizabeth's back in Washington, D.C., where they put on what they did an extensive all over about a 10-year period. And every person who was declared to have to be with the criminal, which basically is a psychopath, but the criminal personality all have these same tendencies or same idea, same things in every one of them, and it's really interesting. And they are really difficult to deal with. For instance, you and I, and here we'll go into a store to buy groceries, or we'll go into the bank to cash a check, or whatever. And we're in there to buy groceries and cash a check. And that's all we're really thinking about. The criminal personality, he's in there, when he goes in, he may be going in to buy groceries and to cash a check, a good check, but at the same time, he's casing the joint. I mean, that's just fix in. And that's the way he is. And he'll just do that automatically. It's really interesting what happens. I think I've gotten away from some of the things I want to do in the rehabilitation. I'm still playing around the edges here. The second rationale for prisons, I'm going to close with this and give you some time for questions. Second rationale for prisons has been that they rehabilitate criminals, and the staggering recidivism statistics have largely discredited this claim and are not made today as often as it was. Norman Carlson, head of the Federal Bureau of Prisons, said in a recent speech that had this been 5 years ago, I'd probably have gotten up here and talked about the glories of rehabilitation. I've given up hope for rehabilitation because there's nothing we can do to force change on offenders. Change has to come from the heart. Michigan legislator Paul Henry, who has worked on these issues at the state level, argues that imprisonment is far more likely to dehumanize men and women than to rehabilitate them. To place a criminal offender in an artificial world composed only of other criminal offenders and then to expect that person to emerge from that abnormal environment as a healthy and whole person is certainly a questionable strategy. what I want, I have here, I'm not going to go into it today, I have here a program for alternatives or improvement in the system. And interestingly enough, it's written by a man who is now a prisoner. I know him personally. And it's an excellent approach. He calls a spade a spade. He's an old-time con. Dell is 52, 53 years old. Ray and I take his, Chaplain Lester and I take his two children up. We take turns up to McNeil Island to visit him. Dell served a lot of time. He is the instigator of our Brother's Keeper movement that I mentioned. And Dell has completely turned his life around. And he's just a fantastic guy. But unfortunately, we have not been able to do anything for him on his time structure. He's looking at somewhere 1990 or something like that. But, and even Dr. Jones, our superintendent at Shelton, who PhD, been in corrections for a long time, stated, we were talking one time, that every inmate reaches a point where he should be let out, regardless of what his time structure is, that they improve. And they hit a peak, then they drop. Then they climb back a little bit, but they never get back up to that ideal time to be released. Now, for some it's 1 year, for some it's much longer. There's no routine pattern for it. But you can watch these men when you're working with them in the prison, and you know when they've reached it. Big pardon?
What are some of the signs they show you when they've reached this stage?
Well, healthy attitudes, positive thinking.
Loss of resentment when they're being there.
Dealing with their, why they're there, dealing with their problem, acknowledging it in a healthy way. Not conning you. You get pretty sharp after a while. You pretty much know when you're being conned.
Are there studies then with regards to this type of person that states what happens as they get back into society? Do they have a high recidivism rate? Or are these the 20% that stay out of prison?
30% that stay out of prison, generally.
And 80% of the time that the people running prisons fail to recognize when the prison has had its maximal advantage for the prisoner involved?
They don't have any control over it. No, they recognize it. They don't have any control over it. Parole board, in this state, parole board does.
That's true, but if I'm sitting on the parole board and I have nothing to do with this prisoner and I have a folder of reports from guards and prison psychiatrist and the counselor and the minister working with the man, and all of these people say this man is showing healthy attitudes, he's dealing with his problem, this man can receive no further benefit from further incarceration, we recommend you parole him, even though that may not be what legally or what fits the mold that you've got. And you mean they ignore what you say and say nuts to you, people don't know what you're talking about?
No, I'm not saying they ignore it. I don't think they do, specifically. But you have to understand the setup, the mechanism of the criminal justice system in the state of Washington. I don't know about other states. But they made a study over X number of years. And out of this study has come now guidelines for every offense, the possibility of reoffending, many, many things. And I don't know what all is involved. They have what they call a public safety score. There's a lot of stuff fed into a computer. And they wind up on each inmate with a guideline from, I'll say, 36 months to 48 months. Parole board then, anywhere in there, can sentence, give him that minimum. Now, maybe their particular felony calls for a 10-year maximum sentence. The parole board then this information goes through the computer and it comes out with a, for that particular offense and that particular type of personality, whatever they feed into this information, that this guidelines for this particular offense is 36 to 48 months. The parole board then can say, okay, we'll give you 30 months. That's his minimum time. Now, and they'll say at that time, we will see you next year on June 15th. June 15th, they see that man, they've got his folder and so forth, they review it. They can at that time, if they want to, reduce that. Or they can add to it, depending on what this man has done.
Are most of the inmates sorry that they have done whatever they're in there for?
I really don't know how to answer that question. Percentage of them are. Percentage of them very definitely are. There's a percentage that have been losers from the basically the day they were born. They have, they're callous from the standpoint their only concern is themselves. They really aren't concerned for you or me or anybody else. It's survival. They live off the street. They live off of what society is built up. And I'm not here to tell you that we got a prison full of good kids out there. I'm not here to tell you that at all.
We've had thousands of years of experience. We have thousands of prisons around the world. There must be some that are more successful than others. Which ones in this country have been the most successful?
I don't have an answer for that. I don't know of any that have been successful.
Maybe an insoluble problem.
Beg your pardon?
Maybe an insoluble problem.
I don't think we've had thousands of years of experience.
No, I don't have either. In this country, we've had something, 1790, I think, is our first prison, and this is...
Go back to the biblical times.
Biblical times, they didn't use imprisonment. I touched on that early in my session. They didn't use imprisonment for punishment. Yes, executed. In some cases they were... given different sentences to do, but they were not in prison, and in some cases it was executed, depending on what it was.
For exile.
Yeah.
Someone told me that the prisons in Texas were self-supporting because they, I know they have labor camps or farming camps. Do you know whether they pay for themselves in Texas? Are they that efficient?
Do you mean the prisoner pays or the...
Through the labors of the prisoners, they pay for.
I don't know about Texas. McNeil Island, when it was a federal penitentiary, was almost completely self-sufficient. They had their own farm. They had everything right there. They grew their own, they had cattle. They had their hog farm and chickens and the whole bit. Monroe has a dairy and the farm, and I'm not sure whether that farm is still going or not. Walla Walla at one time had a food processing line that's since closed down for whatever reason.
Oregon has a similar system, and they grow most of their produce and meat and milk, but there's a great deal of difficulty in materials coming out of prison shops into commercial sales because the businessmen in the different areas around the prison create such a hullabaloo about unfair competition because they can always sell it cheaper than the businessman can produce it, since the prisoner doesn't get paid and the businessman has to pay his employees. And so there's that aspect that's been the hang up about self-supporting prisons in Oregon for a long time.
We have, up here, I don't know if Oregon has a problem. Now, we have a lot of problem with our union situation here in the state, of Washington, in prison industry. Minnesota does a pretty good job, I think. That may be one of the prisons that, as far as their recidivism rate, I don't know what it is in Minnesota, but they do have a program of prison industry that is really excellent. In Llano Lakes, which is, I spent time there, visiting there, some some years ago, and they have a contract with the Bell Telephone Company there, and they refurbish all of the telephones, that the plastic phones that come back in after they've been exchanged or whatever in a house, and they pay their people on a 40-hour week, and they have to work, report to work 8 o'clock in the morning, same as everybody, as we do outside. They have foremen, they have superintendent, foremen, lead men, and workers, and they can work their way up. In that particular program, they were paying a minimum wage. Out of that, they had to pay, on a sliding scale, of course, their room and board, taxes, restitution, if involved, a certain amount of money had to go home, and they were allowed to keep a certain amount for their own spending money, and then the balance was put into a trust fund for them when they got released. And Shakopee, which is a women's prison in Minnesota, had some programs that are somewhat the same. Those are the two I know about anyway.
I have a question about you intimate that in terms of the criminal justice system and overall, that there's a concern about rehabilitative processes within that system, and it sounds like, just from what you've said here today, that if we use that as an umbrella and we use that instance of sex offenders, that man is caught by the police, put into the court system. The court system may say, you're a sexual psychopath, you go to that program in County A, and you're not a psychopath, so you go to prison in County B. Both places, the man's got rehabilitative potential if he chooses to use it and take advantage of it. So it sounds to me as, even though the prison doesn't sound like a very humane place and I wouldn't choose to go there or do something which might put me there, and there may be some of the deterrent of a prison, but it seems to me then the next logical question is, it sounds like we're not falling down as badly as I thought I was going to hear you tell us we are in terms of rehabilitation in the prison. Are we then falling down so badly once they get out of prison that we can't then help them adjust to the same societal pressures that made them go a little bonkers anyway?
Well, we are falling down very badly in rehabilitation. We have very little rehabilitation in our prison system in the state of Washington. We're falling down very badly when we go outside, going out of the prison, because society rejects. We are a punishment-oriented society as opposed to a rehabilitative-oriented society.
Is there more of that on the outside of the prison or on the inside of the prison? Because it seems...
Moreover.
I almost wonder, it's the society that says you've got to be punished for what you've done. It's the society to which the guy has to return, and it sounds like I may be hearing you say, well, we don't have an awful lot in the prison, but it's an awful lot better than it is on the outside, because the guy goes back and everybody keeps punishing him. Won't give him a job,
he gets just as badly punished within the prison by the other inmates.
Mm-hmm. Would it be easier to go straight if I was an ex-con, if the society stopped punishing me once I got out of the prison?
No question about it, absolutely.
Well, it seems to me that the ball's in our lap.
Absolutely.
Once the guy gets out, rather than worrying so much and trying to dump a lot of money into the prison, we ought to be dumping it back into our communities.
You got it.
How can that be done?
Oh boy, that's a loaded question.
I think one of the problems occurs is if you've been in a situation where you've hired ex-cons, I haven't, but I've talked to people that have, and they've had so much trouble with them that
that's right.
They just don't want to touch them again.
Yeah, that's right.
They go through it once, and they go into it with a good, just like you mentioned, good intentions, and
I have to agree with that. I would not disagree with that. I think what we have to look at it from the standpoint of, we're going to have failures. There's no question about it. Also, somewhere, we've got to stop this endless chain and start picking up. And like I said, there's 20 to 25% of people in prison today who need to be locked up and throw the key away. We can't do anything for them. They're gone, this side of the Holy Spirit, as far as I'm concerned, because they have reached, they're so bitter and so hardened that they have no concern for anybody or anything but themselves. The reason must we do that, but there is approximately 75 to 80% who really don't need to be in these huge prisons that we've got. Now, I'm not saying that some of those don't need to be locked up. They do for short periods of time. But we're spending billions of dollars for prisons that could be channeled into programs of rehabilitation.
So you're saying that, what I'm doing is picking up what you're saying and saying, kind of like a halfway house type of situation where there is, and then that has the potential to help a prisoner handle a problem, so he's not the work problem. He then can take some of those problems and deal with them in the home, quotes, his home situation, with some people skilled in helping him deal with them instead of, loading it all on the employer.
That's true.
That would make a big difference.
If you're really interested in, and I recommend a really excellent book if you're interested in reading at all about some of this, is by Carl Menninger, The Crime of Punishment. Crime of Punishment by Carl Menninger, the Menninger Clinic. He wrote an article not too long ago. I think he just died recently. He's an elderly man. Christians Belong in Jail. And it's kind of interesting because, of course, what he's saying is that we as Christians need to be informed of what's going on in our prisons. And really, that's what the point I'm trying to get across is that we as citizens and taxpayers need to know what's happening in our prisons, how we're spending our tax dollars, and at least investigate other possible ways of rehabilitating these people. And we're not gonna do it all. I don't know why, as I said about Monday, I guess it was, I don't know why we feel that we're gonna save them all when Jesus couldn't. that's kind of where we are.
We should have industrial halfway houses.
How do you mean industrial?
Well, have halfway houses where they can earn their own living.
Well, that's where our halfway houses are now.
And produce.
You got a problem with industry. You got a problem with unions.
Well, industry must be blind because even the union or industry or any man that's in business, look at the taxes he's paying.
That's true, but you have to understand that very few of our citizens, of our taxpayers, really understand the amount of money that they're putting into the criminal justice system. We as citizens, kind of like if we have a black sheep in our family, we don't talk about it too much. We kind of keep them in the closet. And that's what we do with our prison system.
It seems to me the prison system has some frills in it that could be cut down in terms of the frill-ness and kind of a bare bones type of place. And
would you name me one?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. It seems, and I hear about it from the outside. You see it more from the inside.
Yeah. I'd like to have you name me one.
Well, I hear about the food strikes, and the food isn't good enough, so they stage a sit-down strike in the dining hall, or their activity lounge.
Let me answer that.
Up to date, so they go on strike and cause a lot of trouble in the prison.
Okay, let me answer that. We have representatives in our government to speak for us, don't we? We have representatives in Washington and senators and so forth and so on.
I mean, we elect people to go
right
to do our thing.
Right. Okay. Inmates have no one to speak for them, including the elected representatives. The only way that they can get some things changed or get themselves in the media so they can deal with some things is sit down, violence, etc., etc. That's what happens.
That hasn't been what I've read about. I read about prison, the prisoners have their leaders, and their leaders get together with the warden, and they have conferences and talks, and when these break down and the guys say no to the representatives that the prisoners send, that then they go on the strikes and the sit-downs and stuff.
Well, I don't know what states are doing that. We don't have much of that in this state. There was at one time, but there is no more. By and large, there is very little.
I guess the position that I have come from has been one, or have come to, has been one of saying, I'd like a prisoner sentenced to prison for a crime against a person in the society, or multiple crimes.
I hear that.
To say, you know, you've done something that we consider to be very bad, and you lose rights when you do that. You have, you know.
Right, nothing wrong with that.
And part of your right is some of the self-determination. And I'd like him to have not spiffy clothes, but adequate clothes to keep him warm, or her. I'd like there to be adequate food, for there to be good nutrition, and I really don't care whether it's terribly tasty or terribly untasty, as long as it will provide good nutrition. Mm-hmm. And I think there ought to be activity, whether that's work, or whether that's a study program, or whether that's a rehabilitation program, that prisoner has to participate in that while they're in there. And that they don't have a choice about that, that by doing an act to someone else, that they lose that choice.
Okay.
That they forsake that. And that's, maybe that's not right, but that's the way I feel.
Yeah, well, that's okay.
And that there ought to be the rehabilitation thing, and it ought to be the guy can say, I don't want it, and if he says, I don't want it, and he's in prison, then his sentence doesn't start until he starts it.
Well,
and that then you ought to take whatever money you get left over, or either tax more, and you ought to get the rehabilitation out in society where these guys have to return, so that we can help them cope with whatever pressures they felt caused them to need to have to do this to begin with.
It's got to be done. Part of it has to be done.
Either
in a probationary system, a deferred sentencing system, depending on the defense,
sure,
so forth, halfway houses, house arrest type things, just a lot of things.
That's
and I agree with most of what you're saying, with the exception is that a lot of the things that you mentioned, you're getting into constitutional rights, you're getting into laws of various states who have set up different things. And it's something that we have to deal with.
Yeah.
Now, for Shelton, the food is good. It's institutional food. It's good food. I eat it. I have no problem with it. I know that if I had to eat it over 3, 4, 5, 6 years, I'd probably get pretty tired of it, but it's still good food. You know, and there's nothing wrong with that. There are programs. The problem is we cannot take into the programming all the guys that want to go into the program. We don't have the facilities for it.
Okay, and so that's a need, I think, that needs to be restored in terms of the public, and that's what you're doing here.
What I'm saying is we need to start looking, my feeling is we need to start looking at alternatives to incarceration. Instead of building 3 new 500-bed prisons in this state, one at Monroe, one at Clallam Bay, and one at Grandview, and take that money and start doing other programming with it. Those people who are nonviolent crimes, they don't have to be in the big prisons. We can then start closing down some of these places like Walla Walla, which should be closed down. We do need a good maximum security facility that says, that's it, fella, you're warehoused, because we've got people like that. Mm-hmm. By and large, what you're saying, I have no problem with.
Sometimes,
but we have to do it humanely and remember that that person is a child of God and a human being, regardless of what he's done.
I can do that, and then I can say, well,
you don't have to like what he did. I'm not saying that.
And he may not like what we do, and he may say, well, I'm not going to eat unless you do it differently.
It's his choice.
A choice of his. And we could get into the.
But there's also you have to understand that there is a lot of inhumanity goes on in prisons.
True,
I agree, but also
it's
in a concentrated situation.
Yeah,
you have no choice but to take it in a prison. And I think we need, that's the, some of the things we need to look at, and that we're, that
they're going on. Sometimes I think they stress constitutional rights too heavily.
Well,
why, when they have committed a crime, it should be like they can't vote. Why should they have as much constitutional right as I have?
Because somewhere back around 1776, somebody said so. I can't argue that one with
you. That constitutional right is this. Well, look at the Fifth Amendment. Are they?
Let's face it. They've bent it around and they've. But who's done that? Who's done that?
I don't think we have to worry about prisoners voting. They never voted before they went to prison.
Yeah. They don't.
Very few of them. You'd be surprised. There's some pretty neat people. There's some pretty neat people in these prisons.
One thing bothers me about our present society is that in Yakima, 72% of the prisoners in the county jail are Chicanos. And they have 25% population.
Yeah, we have a few of them.
I think it. We did some revolving work with Law. As I recall, about 50% of the prisoners there are black. We have about 2% of our population.
But if you look at the socioeconomic grouping out of which they come, I think that explains a lot about what they're getting, the troubles they're getting into, because they just while. Some of the abuse that people suffer as children does not necessarily confine itself to lower socioeconomic strata.
No, very definitely.
Probably more common, and as you pointed out, have less place to run in a lower socioeconomic strata. They can run, but they get the same thing from all over the place. We have more flexibility in terms of going between levels of society and getting them.
And also the bottom line, I think, if you really get down to the bottom line is, these people don't have money, and if you've got money, you can do a lot of things. If you don't have money, in the criminal justice system, in our system, money speaks. You know that, and I know that. I mean, I want to admit it, but
money is the universal leveler of frustration.
You better believe. And that's something we should change.
Yeah.